Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, stocks and other forms of equity. This is a words and terms and definitions kind of a subject. But then it also has some other implications that are more mathematical. Now, this is where I'm going to show you a couple of tricks with the calculator where you can get things done a lot faster than if you were to try to do it the old-fashioned way, the way they'll show you in the book. However, there are some other issues involved in this, too, that I have to go through. Before anything else, let me get out of Zoom, which is causing all kinds of problems today. And I don't know why. It's just like half the time it's not working now. Give me a second here. I'm going to try one more time before I give up on this. New tab. I swear. Okay, I'm glad. Come on. Well, one way or the other. I'm not going to worry too much about it. If they can get some sound feed, that's fine. But okay, first of all, quick look at the numbers, see what we've got. Well, I'll be darned. At least we got something going there. Jeez, I swear, I'm tired of technology. I'm ready to go back to the caves. Okay. Now, quick look at the numbers here. As you can see, this is one of those inverted days. The biggest companies, the bigger the company group, the worse it did. The Dow 30 was actually plowed a little bit, nothing, major. But then the S&P 500 crawled out a little bit, and the NASDAQ did a pretty darn decent day. It's one of those odd balls where more of the action was toward the smaller cap companies. And, I can give you lots of different reasons why that would be, and it's actually kind of speculative, but when you see a pattern like this, it's more than just random, that there's something in there that's going on. Where would I guess that the action is? Why is the pattern the way it is? Well, mostly because we have mixed signals, but we did have a rather bad number for the manufacturing over the last quarter. It was released early this morning, I think it was, said that our manufacturing sector slowed by about 0.7% over the last month. I think it was month. That was the second time we've gotten that in a row. That would tend to indicate that we may be moving toward that stagnation, even before interest rates go up. And once interest rates go up, it's going to be really, really bad. And I'm planning on a lecture, I believe it will be next week. I will give the lecture about how this works, this kind of interaction between the financial markets, interest rates, politics, and the fate of the U.S. economy. The grim part of that is that if the numbers are pointing the way it looks like right now, we're not going to be in good shape when you guys are going out there for your jobs in about a year and a half. So I do have a couch, but I charge terrible rent, and you have to bring snacks every day. But I don't want to discourage you. Get out there, get yourself your internship, get yourself secured with connections so that you can get a job even if things get to be a little bit sour. Now, no, this isn't something that's just happened. This has been building for about five years now, this mess that we're getting into and getting out of it. There's a lot of talk that the current chairman of the Federal Reserve is not going to be, usually there's a second term. Yeah, you did good, we're going to give you a second term. This time might not happen because, well, for a couple of reasons, but I won't get into that right now. But anyway, where the hell was I? Oh, okay. Going over here. Well, there you go. Okay. Oh, look at that. Remember where's the next target? Where's the next goal for the oil markets? Yeah, they made it through the 75, and now they're heading for 90. Once you get to 90, you really begin to see it in gas prices. Right now, we're not in too bad a shape. We're in the 330 to 350 a gallon range. In Chicago, that's $20 to $30 range. But it's getting up there. If we cross that $90 neckline, you'll see $4.19 a gallon, and that will hurt the economy. As that gas price goes up, we need the gasoline and the diesel fuels and the jet fuels, the distillates, the kerosene. We need all that. We need it. So it's going to be draining money from other sectors of the economy, which will pretty much snuff out the recovery as it's starting. One good thing about this. You see those oil prices going up. That's bad for all of us. We're paying more for gas. However, the higher hydrocarbon prices are, the more competitive alternate technologies are to research and develop. In other words, as you get gasoline prices, oil prices going higher, that makes it more attractive to find out if there are other things that we could use instead of hydrocarbon products. That means more wind turbine technology research, solar technologies, electric cars that can actually go more than to the store and back, stuff like that. So the bad side is, yes, we pay more, it slows down the economy. However, it makes the technological substitutes, alternatives to fossil-based fuels, attractive. Ultimately, yeah, that means we also are going to end up having to have more nukes. But down the road, that will, these old dangerous, no matter what you do, they're still nasty. The old fission reactors will give way to a new technology in about 20 years, the fusion. In other words, we will fire up the stars right on Earth, and that'll be very cool. Clean energy as far as the eye can see, and a way to get rid of any kind of waste you want by pouring it into the plasma fields, and it'll just disappear, which is very cool too. Anyway, now, over here. Bonds. The yield went up, the price went down. Okay, yield went up. See it? Yield went up about 6.5 basis points. So, in other words, the yields are on the move. That would mean that prices fell. Why would prices fell? Because investors are moving away from the bonds. And the yields are going up to try to attract the bond buyers back. But for now, that's a sign that interest rates in general are going to go up. Why are interest rates going up? Well, the Fed sure isn't contracting the money supply now. So most likely, that is the result of expected inflation beginning to slide in. Yes, the inflation is coming. It's already here. But like I said, what's even worse than inflation is expected inflation. Because we can make inflation go away tomorrow. But the expectation, once we have gotten inflation embedded, everyone from the labor unions and the workers to the companies that price their products to the banks that set the interest rates on loans, they are not going to believe it. They're going to have their expectation of inflation that'll go on long past the time when the money supply is being contracted to stop the inflation. Enough of that. Now, let me go on here. A couple of last minute notes. The capital asset pricing model. And I'm going to write this on the board because it kind of dovetails into what we're doing in this chapter. Really? What the heck? Oh, the camera fell down. Are you guys screwing around with a camera up there? If anyone has a broom, could you just kind of push it up a little bit? No, don't do that. Ugh, okay. In other words, I have the lower half, about the lower two-thirds of the board. Okay, CAPM, the capital asset pricing model. Now, I'm going to write on the board here. And the expected return to a stock, a portfolio, a project. This applies across the board, is the risk-free rate plus the beta of the thing times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Now, again, this thing right here is called the market premium. This is just the pure reward for taking risk instead of no risk. You're going to graduate from college. Now, if you have a decent major, you're going to get maybe $60,000 a year. Now, if you had gone to work right out of high school, no risk involved, just get a job, you're probably going to pull about $24,000 a year. And then you're going to... Your more liberal advocates are going to say, well, that's not a living wage. Well, you could have tried something else. But, you know, let's just say $24,000. You'll make it, but it won't be much. You see, that risk premium is the difference between $60,000 and $24,000 in an interest rate kind of way. What extra you would get for taking risk instead of no risk. Yes, you get a reward for taking no risk. It's just a pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. You are going to get a reward. You should get a reward if you put money away. Even if it's riskless, you don't get to have it. So when I put money into a government treasury bill, I'm going to get my money back. There's no question about that. The government will print money if it has to. It'll attack another country and liquidate its assets if it has to. It'll do whatever it has to pay me back, so it's riskless. But that doesn't mean I don't get any reward. I get a reward because I didn't get to use my money for a while. I put in about maybe $990, and I get $1,000 back in a year. The $10 is my reward for not using the $990. So, for heaven's sakes, let me get this down. So, now, this was developed for the purpose of finding out what discount rate to use. So in other words, if I've got a stream of cash flows that will come from a project, I can find the beta of the project, put the numbers in, and we'll get out a discount rate that I can use. This is the classic way to do it. Now, for example, if the expected return to the market portfolio right now is 8.0%. The risk-free rate is 1.50%. let's say that we got a beta of a stock. The beta of some stock is 0.6. This is a safe stock. Then I can push this formula, and the expected return to this stock is going to be 1.5% plus 0.6 times 8.0 minus 1.50%. Oops. Now, the first thing that I would do here, I'm going to do this just for illustration. This thing is the market premium over risk-free. In other words, this is the additional, for this example, this is the additional that you would get. Now, let me do something here. Bear with me. I'm going to go here to a site. And you know, let me say here. Really? What the heck? Why am I having a hard time? Well, I can't. I was going to bring up the Zoom so I could share it, but it's being such a butt right now. But let me show you something. Oh, there it is. I didn't see it there. It's not on my screen where I can see it. It's kind of hidden. Thank you. Wow. You know, hire the old man. He's fun to watch. Okay, here you go. There's your damn screen. Okay, now, what I'm bringing up here is, this is the Treasury rates. Now, I could say, well, let's look at a 1 year. Right now, 1 year Treasury is at 0.12%. These are percentages, so you can see how low interest rates are right now. This is the continuing effort of the Federal Reserve for the last almost 5 years now to keep the economy from falling into a pit by keeping interest rates low. How do you keep the interest rates low? By oversupplying what the interest rates are the price of. Interest rates are the price of money. So if you want to keep the price of money low, you oversupply the money. So there's why you got the inflation that is starting to come bubbling up like a bandit. We've been overprinting money since 2017. Why? Because in 2017, the economy needed to go into a recession. And the president at the time threatened to fire the chairman of the Federal Reserve, which had never even been thought could be done. But the chairman and all the governors peed their pants and started cranking out money in gobs and gobs over and over for 4 long years. And they are still doing it because now we're printing money to send out for COVID relief checks and for infrastructure bills and everything else under the sun. So we're still not stopping the printing press. And because we crushed the tax rates on corporations down to a high from the 39% it was in 2016, down to a flat 21%, it's the highest any corporation could pay, and most don't pay anything, yeah, budget deficits through the roof. So how does the Treasury fund itself? By the issuing Treasury bills, which the Federal Reserve comes and buys, and thereby lends the government money. Well, what does the Fed use to buy all that Treasury debt? It prints money to do it. And then, of course, we have the Chinese who lend us some of the money, and the Japanese, and the Russians, and the Canadians, and the Scandinavians, and everyone else on Earth. Takes care of us because we can't take care of ourselves. But there's why the interest rate at 0.12. So in other words, realistically right now, that'd be 0.12, that R sub F. Now, I want to give a, just, I mean, this is kind of arcane, and I've been teaching the CAPM my entire academic career. And I always say, well, let's go to the yields for one-year treasuries, risk-free rate. Good thing for it. Although some would argue you might want to use the 1 month, which is insanely small right now. But there's a growing movement for the CAPM not to use the 1 year, but to use the 7 year. Now, I got into a little bit of a fun argument with a couple of younger theoreticians. And I said, why would you use, the 7 years going to have some maturity premium in it. That's not going to be a pure riskless rate because it's going to have that one risk component, a 7 year maturity premium. I said, so why in the hell would you use that? And unfortunately, they came back with not a bad argument. They said, look, usually we're getting the CAPM to get a discount rate for stock or for a project or something like that. Those aren't one-year things. Those are long, long things. A seven-year is sort of a compromise between the shortest types of stock and projects on through to things that can last forever. So a one-year isn't appropriate for most things that we would ever use a CAPM to get a discount rate for. Okay, granted, I'm still going to use a one-year for it, but I do understand. So if you do cross another class sometime, here or in an MBA program, you might see them use a seven-year for the CAPM. But I guarantee you that any finance course you're going to cross that has any value at all, you're going to see the CAPM again. It's our triumph. This was developed in the 1960s. Brief thing about it. This tells us an expected return to an investment. It's not what will happen, but it's what we expect. You know, there's variation. There's standard deviation of possibilities and all that. Well, this hit in academics. Now, this is it. This is right. The theory behind it. It's a simple linear equation, but it seems to be, all of our empirical data says this is pretty much dead on to what we know the beta of a stock. We can look over a long period of time, and the expected return really is what CAPM says it should be. Yeah.
Can you redefine what CAPM was?
Capital Asset Pricing Model. Okay, sorry about that. Sort of like CAPM in my world is like SOS in everyone else's world or something like that. I don't think to repeat it. Okay, here's the thing, though. One of the places where this started getting out into actual practical uses, regulatory agencies that gave monopoly in states to power companies, to water companies, things like that, they say, you can have all of the customers. We won't let any other electric company provide them customers. But in exchange for that, we will tell you how much you can make. And we do that by telling you what rates you can charge, if it's for natural gas, electricity, water, whatever. And this has been around for a century or more. Well, in the 1970s, some state regulatory agencies overseeing electric companies started using the CAPM to determine what the appropriate expected return to the investors of the electric company should be given the risk, the beta of the enterprise. And so then they could back up and say, all right, you should set this rate per kilowatt hour or something like that. Well, in one case, and I don't recall the state, I think it was an East Coast state, the company, the electric company, said we should get a rate of return for our investors, for our stockholders, of 16.5%. That's what we should get. The regulators, who had just gotten out of some of the best schools that were starting to teach the CAPM, said, oh, no. Utility companies are some of the safest companies on earth. Their betas that we're calculating are like 0.3, 0.4. The utility company should get a rate of return based upon the CAPM of about 5%. Oh, my God, the utility company just had a fit. No, it's 16.5%. That's what we, our analysts, have said, decided. And the regulators were saying, no, according to the best models we now have, which at the time was the CAPM, and still is, by the way, it's 5. Well, it went to court, and the judge just absolutely laughed his ass off at the CAPM. He said, some mumbo-jumbo by airheads at some college thought this up. 16.5% is fine. Not mentioning the fact that the power company contributed to that judge's campaigns, election campaigns, every 2 years. But so finally, it was only in the 1980s that the CAPM started getting embraced as the true model. And to this day, it still is. Now, the one that has kind of taken a little bit of steam, but it's still, it's rejected by most of us. There's a version of this that says that a company's risk isn't a single beta, but there's a series of betas representing different dimensions of risk. Different as, if you want, the mathematics of orthogonal vectors of risk. It's called the APT, the arbitrage pricing theory, and I think they even mention it in the book. It's not widely embraced yet. But let me show you one last thing before I get over to the stocks thing. This equation graphs like this. Beta is on this axis, and the expected return is on this axis. Now, the R sub F is just a plain old y-intercept. This is really just y equals mx plus b. Again, y equals, let me get this right, mx, x is the independent, beta is the independent variable, plus the y-intercept b. So in other words, this is the risk-free rate, which would have a beta of 0. See, if I put a 0 there, the only thing is the R sub f, so you've got 0 comma R sub f. That's a point. Now, in other words, I've got a point on the CAPM model right here. Now, out here, if I graphed 1.0 beta, if I put a 1.0 in there, that'd be R sub F plus the expected return to the market minus R sub F. So that would be 1 comma expected return to the market portfolio. Now, there's a point to this. It's not just all theoretical. But remember that 2 points determine a line. So in other words, this is the CAPM line. We call it the securities market line. Now, you've got to be careful here because there's another one called the capital market line. For heaven's sakes, I'm going to ask it. I will ask it on the final. I promise you. Don't trip on it. Now, why am I going to ask this? If there's a chance that you could trip on it and really not be stupid, but you just make a mistake with it, is because it's such a standard question that this is called the securities market line. So on this one, you tell me a beta And I can tell you what your expected return to the stock is, graphically, or I can do it mathematically like I was doing over there before I lost my train of thought. Now, that's kind of a great thing because, you see, if you tell me, you, madam, are a portfolio manager, and someone has said, well, this person got a return on her portfolio of 12%. Okay. Well, first thing I'd say is, what's the beta? Well, the beta was about 1.8. Well, a beta of 1.8 should buy me a 14% return. So actually, that portfolio underperformed its risk level. That's a key important reason why whenever I get someone bragging, and I've done this and got very embarrassed when they said, well, this fund manager got this high return. I said, what was the beta? And usually they'll say, I don't know. I said, well, I don't have any use for you. Please shut up and sit down because you haven't told me what risk you took. If you took a risk that you may have taken a huge risk and you should have earned more than this awesome thing. You made 25%. Well, if you had told me your beta was 2.8, and I tell you that you actually suck as an investor. You see, return means nothing if you don't tell me what risk you took. You, sir, told me that you made $40,000 last year. Awesome. What did you do? Well, I jumped off buildings without a parachute. Well, hell, that's not for that kind of risk. No. Ow. Of course, then again, I'm considering the possibility of an active shooter. I should be paid more, but, you know, not around here. You guys are all nice. I think. You're good. But you see, that's the thing is, even in our own lives, what risk am I taking to make what I'm making? You see, the CAPM is telling us about the world around us. There is a mathematical relationship. It isn't soft and touchy and feely. Now, let me tell you another thing about this, and I'll bring this up. It's kind of amazing. It's not just this time, but this time I've seen so many places, so many people, and on YouTube, TikTok, places like that, where someone's just special, magical, and usually they're not. I run a ghost hunting club. You would not believe the number of people who let me know that they're psychics or sensitives, and I throw away their applications. Or the people who say, well, I've got this special talent. No, you don't. You say you're a very good singer. No, you're actually terrible. You see, however, that does not mean that you can't see magic. And sometimes we will see portfolios. Okay, the risk was this, and the expected return should be this. But I'll be a darned if the actual return is above the securities market line. It's not normal, but it does happen. This is what you're always looking for, is the fund manager who's got just a special something about his or her way of looking at securities price movements. Or the day trader, for the most part, day traders today, right now, versus 25 years ago, the day traders of 25, 30 years ago, they're still losing compared to the pros. Overall, you'll lose. And it's no different now than it was back then. There's no more, the internet has made a democratization. No. From every piece of data we see, you still, as a day trader, you still suck. However, there are some who don't. And I guarantee you that no matter what brokerage house you're with, they're tracking you to see if you're one of the special day traders. They are watching you. And how do I know that? Because I've done it too. And we talk about the special people. How many? What is it? Maybe 1 in 1,000 They're taking big risks. Don't get me wrong. Day traders are insane with the risks they take, and they don't really even realize it. But every once in a while, you see a day trader whose portfolio is outperforming the market. And when I say the market's down here. What I'm talking about, for its risk level, it is outperforming the market at that risk level. It happens. Now, here's the thing that we use to describe this. Here's the beta of a portfolio. Here's its expected return right here. Here's its actual return up here. This distance right here, we call this Jensen's alpha. It's called Jensen's alpha. Now, you'll actually see mutual funds always. I mean, you go on Yahoo, Bloomberg, you look and they'll always show you the alpha. It's usually about zero or a little negative or a tiny bit positive. It's going to be, you know, statistically not significantly different from zero. But every now and then you see one, holy cow, that Jensen's alpha is positive. Now, the problem with that is that once it's positive, you're going to see buying into it. And that will drive the price up. And so the next fool buying into it isn't going to get that big return because everyone before him has jumped in already. However, the Jensen's alpha is something to look for when you're investing. And also look for it in yourself. In a course after this one, one of the projects the students do is in groups they work on their... They do a portfolio, simulate a portfolio. They start with $100,000, and then over the semester, they manage it. They buy, they sell, they keep it balanced, speculating, whatever they want to do. And then we look at the end, and one of the parameters, if anyone has a positive Jensen's alpha that's more than statistically significant, they get an A. Okay, well, I'll be damned if I didn't get two with positive Jensen's alphas. One of them had the expected return to the portfolio, given the beta they had on that portfolio, was like 12.5%. My God, this one group got a Jensen's alpha of positive, more than positive 3. They were up above 15%. I mean, that's a hell of, the other one was like about 1%. The Jensen's alpha was about 1%. Still, that's not bad. Then I had the group that had a Jensen's alpha that was like negative 10%. Their risk was about somewhere in here. They were actually a low-risk portfolio, which should have had a return about here. Well, they had a return of about zero. And then there was one group in there. They'd gotten their portfolio, invested it at $100,000, and they finally came to me in week 10 of the course and said they had $10,000 left. And so what do you do if it's $10,000. I don't think, how am I going to get my $100,000 back? That's gone. But what do you do if you are in that kind of trouble? And you know that your professor is looking for a reason to eat you alive. What would you do? And this is getting us to the stock thing. Kill yourself? No. Go move to an island and become, a Rastafarian and smoke weed? No. You throw a Hail Mary. That's all you can do. If you have to do it. So what did we do? Wait a minute. Let me go here. NVIDIA. At the time, its beta was about 2. American Micro Devices, its beta was about 3 at the time. The only thing you can do is just hope that the market comes through for you. You throw what you've got left into high beta stocks, because high beta would be high expected return. That's the only possible way that you could get this back. It's just like in gambling. At the end of the night, the gambler has $50 of the $5,000 he had when he went in that afternoon. All he can do is throw the money at the riskiest game on the board, in the casino, and hope that it takes. It probably won't, but it's the only chance you've got. In their case, unbelievable. Both of those came through, and they ended at about $96,000. So, yeah, obviously, I'm not going to criticize when you have something that recovery like that. That's pretty awesome. Okay. Now, I wanted to make sure you know. There's another trip there, killed myself. Let me show you something here. You remember I showed you that if the frontier of efficient investments that tracks the total risk, sigma, standard deviation, against expected return. Now, as I said, this is an efficient investment curve. You can't get past this curve. This is an envelope. In your current condition, you can't lift 500 pounds. Maybe someday, yes, but not now. Right now, you could not pass the medical boards. So don't tell me that you're going to help me operate on my appendix.
Hail Mary.
Yeah, there you go. No. In other words, every investment is somewhere in here. Now, some are very close, but many are very far away. Along here is world market portfolios of different balances. The trick was that where the CAPM came from was noticing that there was a way to jump the efficient investments frontier. Because you can always invest in a completely riskless portfolio of treasuries, the risk-free rate. So there's a way you can get around that kind of sucks. Yeah, you don't get any very good return for no risk, but it shows that there is a way to get away from the frontier. If I can create what we call, obviously, a tangent line onto a market portfolio, what that means, graphically, whatever, but what it means in practice is, if I took a market portfolio, like the spider, and I took treasury bills, and I said, these are the only things I'm going to invest in, then I could do half treasuries, half market, get this return, and I'm off the frontier. Let me say that again. If I just took half treasuries, totally riskless, and half spiders, 1.0 betas, well, I'd be halfway from here to here. I'm off the frontier, and I get halfway between risk-free rate and the expected return of the market portfolio, and I'm not on the efficient investments curve. I've broken it I hate doing this, I can't help myself. Once we start breaking the speed of light with warp drives, we won't be able to just fly willy-nilly, wee, in TARDIS boxes and all that. But we will be able to fly, but we'll have to fly along specific vectors, warp vectors. We can break the speed of light, but we have to do it the right way. And this is the same thing as happens in investments. We can break the efficient frontier of investments, but we have to do it with treasury bills and market portfolio. Combine them. And you say, well, how do you get out here? Oh, that would be when I actually borrow money and leverage myself. In other words, leverage out to this part of the curve. What's this thing called? This is called, for it, unfortunately, it's called the capital market line. The capital market line is the line that connects the risk-free rate with the market portfolio. The capital market line is the line that connects the risk-free rate with the market portfolio. Okay. Now notice that the capital market line is for that. The securities market line is for the capital asset pricing model. That's where the confusion gets. Again, the securities market line is the graph of the capital asset pricing model. The capital market line is not. Okay. You should be able to jump into your quiz now.